The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Welcome to the Christian Outlook, the weekly radio program that sorts through the issues in our fast-changing world in a way that honors your Christian faith. Brought to you in partnership with our sponsor, the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy. I'm Gino Geraci. Great to be with you. This week, dramatic testimony on Capitol Hill on the dangers of Instagram.
Facebook knows that Instagram dramatically changes the experience of high school.
We'll look at how social media has changed us.
And that, I think, takes away some of the, what I would call, temperature controls.
And we'll look at the demographic of those most negatively impacted.
32% of teen girls said that when they felt bad about their bodies, Instagram made them feel worse.
Plus, a closer look at Banned Books Week.
In 2021, I argue, book banning has actually appeared in the United States.
All this and more. I'm Gino Geraci, your host this week, coming to you from my home station, 94.7 FM The Word in Denver, where I host Crosswalk with Gino Geraci each weekday afternoon. You can hear my own program on 94.7 FM and 94.7FMTheWord.com. Take a moment to follow Christian Outlook on Twitter, at TC Outlook, that's TC Outlook, and follow me as well, at Geraci Gino. Great to be with you. We'll begin in Washington, D.C., and the revealing hearings of a former Facebook employee before a Senate subcommittee. Frances Haugen had appeared in a segment for 60 Minutes that aired on CBS last Sunday and cooperated in a series of articles for the Wall Street Journal. Many of you may have known that Instagram has had a negative impact on young people. But Facebook, the owner of Instagram, knows as well. It was their unwillingness to address the harmful impact of their products that pushed Ms. Haugen to go public.
They know that severe harm is happening to children. For example, in the case of bullying, Facebook knows that Instagram dramatically changes the experience of high school. Kids who are bullied on Instagram, the bullying follows them home. It follows them into their bedrooms. The last thing they see before they go to bed at night is someone being cruel to them. Or the first thing they see in the morning is someone being cruel to them.
We are at something of a crossroads in our culture. We know that social media usage is ubiquitous among teens. We know that the biggest company in the business recognizes that such usage is harmful. But recognizing those facts is a long way from addressing the issues in any substantive way. Carl Truman of Grove City College joined John Hall and Kathy Emmons on Word FM in Pittsburgh.
I think what I was mostly surprised at is the data that Facebook had on young women and how poorly they respond to Instagram, especially when it comes to body image issues,
right.
And how deeply Facebook already understands that and is basically unrepentant for it. So talk to us first off about the news from Facebook. What are your thoughts about social media in this regard?
I think social media is in some ways the great unknown quantity as we move into the future at the moment, because it's very clear that it has a profound impact, particularly upon the way young people and particularly on the way, I think, young women think about themselves. Abigail Schreier's book, Irreversible Damage, on the trans movement among young teenage and 20-something girls makes it very clear that a lot of that is being driven by images and narratives being presented via social media. So I think we're at an interesting point in our lives and in the culture's history where we don't know where this is going, but we know it's going to be profound in its impact.
What about, Carl? So there you are, Grove City College. You're surrounded by people, young people especially, who profess belief in Jesus Christ. How do you think that affects believers? I mean, is there any delineation, or is it just all the same ball of wax?
Yeah, I think for Christians it poses particular challenges. And one of the things I try to emphasize to students in class is, you know, we are bodies. The tendency today is to make us think that our bodies are appendages to us. They're instruments that we use. And I say, no, we are actually our bodies. And that's why the resurrection is very important to the doctrine. It's not enough to have our sins forgiven. it's not over until we're resurrected, because that's you. You're a body, and you're going to be resurrected. I think the tendency on social media is, of course, away from embodiment and towards this sort of disembodied performance. And I think that that is not a neutral thing for Christians. Anything that downplays the importance of the physical body and a physical presence, that's not a neutral thing for Christians. And we need to be very careful about how the way we imagine the world is being tilted in a disembodied kind of direction.
That's interesting. So in some ways, I get exactly what you're saying about the disembodiment of it all. But at the same time, when you look at social media or just, you know, the internet itself, it's awash in bodies, right? The pornification of America and those who engage in it. I mean, that essentially has changed the culture as well.
It has, but it's bodies of a certain kind. It's unreal sort of bodies, if I could put it that way. There's a big difference between watching pornography on a screen and actually having sexual relationship with somebody. There's a big difference between debating somebody via Twitter and actually sitting in the same room, looking them in the eye, and engaging in discussion. What happens on screen is we tend to forget that the people we're dealing with, the people we're looking at, they're actually real persons with real history, etc., etc. We tend to treat them simply as objects or ideas. And one of the ways this manifests itself, I think, is, you know, typically if you're in a room discussing a controversial subject with friends, the temperature will lower because you're bodily there with them. And there are all these kind of subliminal bodily tells that help to lower the temperature. If you're just firing off things on Twitter, there's no body there. There's no face to look at. There's no eye to make contact with. And that, I think, takes away some of the, what I would, you know, call temperature controls in the discussions we have, and feeds into the increasing polarization and anger that characterize discourse in the modern West.
This issue of the harmful impact of social media hits close to home for most of us. Even if you don't use or feel your own use of social media is very disciplined, our kids and our grandkids may well be at a different place. And we genuinely ought to be concerned. Albert Mohler looked at the impact of Instagram on our young people, and our young girls in particular, from his briefing program.
We're talking about the effect of Facebook, of social media in general, but Facebook in particular, on young people, children and teenagers, particularly teenagers and young adults, and particularly girls and young women. This article tells us that Facebook knew that its Instagram platform in particular, which is very much targeted these days towards growing an ever larger younger audience, we now know that Facebook knew it was dangerous. Internal documents that were leaked to the Wall Street Journal included these words, quote, 32% of teen girls said that when they felt bad about their bodies, Instagram made them feel worse. In the same research, the inside document from Facebook said, quote, comparisons on Instagram can change how young women view and describe themselves, end quote. Addressing the platform Instagram, the Wall Street Journal summarized, quote, for the past 3 years, Facebook has been conducting studies into how its photo sharing app affects its millions of young users. Repeatedly, says the journal, the company's researchers found that Instagram is harmful for a sizable percentage of them, most notably teenage girls. One of the slides from an internal presentation at Facebook about Instagram said, quote, we make body image issues worse for 1 in 3 teen girls. Just consider that. 1 in 3. And we're told the slide had summarized research about adolescent girls who experience the issues. Another slide said this, quote, teens blame Instagram for increases in the rate of anxiety and depression. This reaction was unprompted and consistent across all groups, end quote. So Facebook was at least acknowledging internally to itself that it had become a problem. Its Instagram platform in particular had become dangerous, indeed toxic, for many young people. Remember that percentage. 1/3 of teenage girls who were using Instagram indicated this effect. The commercial aspect of this is very clear with reference to the profit line for Facebook. The Wall Street Journal, which if any newspaper in the world knows how to read a financial statement, said this, quote, expanding its base of young users is vital to the company's more than $100 billion in annual revenue, and it doesn't want to jeopardize their engagement with the platform. We're told in the following data point that more than 40% of Instagram's users are 22 years old and younger, and we're told about 22 million teenagers in the United States log on to Instagram every single day. Now, an interesting note here is that only about 5 million American teenagers log into Facebook. Facebook is evidently where their parents go. They go to Instagram, and they go there to compare. We are told that this is one of the most dangerous mental health aspects of Instagram for especially young women and teenage girls, because the comparison is extremely harmful. The Wall Street Journal summarizes, quote, "The features that Instagram identifies as most harmful to teens appear to be at the platform's core." The next paragraph, quote, "The tendency to share only the best moments, a pressure to look perfect, and an addictive product can send teens spiraling towards eating disorders, an unhealthy sense of their own bodies, and depression. This according not to external analysis, but to March 2020 internal research at Facebook." Quote, "It warns that the Explore page, which serves users' photos and videos curated by an algorithm, can send users deep into content that can be harmful." The research inside Facebook said, quote, "Aspects of Instagram exacerbate each other to create a perfect storm," end quote. Now, supposedly, teenagers have to be 13 in order to be on Instagram. But as we know, there are ways around that. But just to make very clear how intent Facebook is on getting younger viewers addicted to its platform, understand that Instagram had announced months ago that it was going to be releasing a new platform for children under age 13. The company has backed off of that, given the criticism, and of course what is now an avalanche of data coming not from outside the company, but we know from inside the company. There is more in the research that came out. We're told, quote, "Facebook's researchers identified the over-sexualization of girls as something that weighs in the mental health of the app's users." Clearly, the main vulnerability here is young women and teenage girls, but Facebook's internal information, as reported by the Wall Street Journal, includes the fact that teenage boys also aren't immune. As the story in the Wall Street Journal tells us, quote, "In the deep dive Facebook's researchers conducted into mental health in 2019, they found that 14% of boys in the United States said Instagram made them feel worse about themselves. In their report on body image in 2020, Facebook's researchers found that 40% of teen boys experienced negative social comparison," end quote. Now, did you hear that? The number jumped from 14% to 40%. 4 out of 10 adolescent boys reporting on their experience of Instagram said that physical comparison on the platform caused them insecurities as well as their female friends. Now, as we know, adolescence itself is a time of vulnerability. It's a time of anxiety. It is a time of endless comparison. It turns out that the platforms of social media are simply an explosive that blows that up to unparalleled proportions, reaching percentages of the young population that go far beyond, I think, what most parents might even imagine in their worst nightmare.
Coming up, Banned Books Week.
Book banning has actually appeared in the United States.
When the Christian Outlook returns in a moment. Stay with us.
The Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy believes in the calling to politics and public service. As one of the few programs of its kind based at a leading Christian university, we prepare students for exciting careers in this vital arena through a curriculum that combines rigorous study of America's founding principles with the latest tools of policy analysis. The application period for fall 2022 classes has begun, so find out more at pepperdine.edu/SPP. That's pepperdine.edu/SPP.
Welcome back to the Christian Outlook. I'm Gino Geraci. The week of September 26th to October 2nd was officially Banned Books Week. It's an annual event that started some 40 years ago, put on by the American Library Association and the American Booksellers Association. The layers of hypocrisy here are many. Tom Spence is the president of Regnery Publishing. He wrote a column for the Wall Street Journal that points to some of this hypocrisy in the title, Banned Books Week. Well, it isn't actually interested in banned books. He was a guest of Jerry Boyer on Jerry's Meeting of Minds podcast.
So why'd you write this op-ed?
Well, Banned Books Week has been around for a long time, since the early 80s. And every year when it rolls around, I'm always slightly annoyed. I go between being annoyed and amused because the whole thing for years has been an exercise in hypocrisy. In fact, one of my old colleague from Spence Publishing days, a guy called Mitch Muncy, wrote an op-ed in the Wall Street Journal maybe 15 years ago, poking fun at Banned Books Week. And the point there was none of the books that you will find promoted in your bookstore or at your public library during Banned Books Week has ever been banned in any real sense. Right? And I mean, I would define banned, and I think most people would, as meaning that a book has been removed from circulation, that somebody who wants that book, someone in the general public who wants that book, can't find it, or at least it's very difficult to find. The place that you'll find most of the titles from the Banned Books Week promotion is the bestseller list. So they're, you know, not really banned. What they have in common is not that someone from the government or Big Brother has removed them from the market. What they have in common is that they almost entirely express a left-wing point of view on something, and usually something having to do with sex or race. Mm. The books that have always been promoted on Banned Books Week have been challenged. That's the word they'll use in the small type, meaning that some parent somewhere found some book extolling the newest frontiers of the sexual revolution in their kindergartner's school library.
Right.
And objects to that, right?
Yes. That's banning. And they never take them. They don't take them out of the school library.
No.
I mean, it's almost like, oh, finally, a parent came forward, you know, and asked about this so that we can consider this a challenged book and therefore upgrade it to the banned list.
Yeah.
Which we can then go ahead and sell the living daylights out of this book and turn that into a marketing gimmick. Because it exactly. is. I mean, it amounts to a marketing gimmick at this point, doesn't it?
Oh, that's what it is. What provoked me to sit down and write this op-ed this year was that in 2021, I argue, book banning has actually appeared in the United States. You know, but before that, it's been very hard to argue that any book is banned in a meaningful sense. You know, that hasn't happened in a long time. But now there are real efforts and sometimes successful to ban books, meaning make them unavailable to somebody who wants it. And that's started happening in the past year. And guess what? None of those books is featured in your banned
book. Of course not. Abigail Schreier, Ryan Anderson, is it Deborah So? None of the people who are crossways with the alphabet agenda, who are probably the most banned. That's probably the most banned category of authors.
Yeah.
None of those people actually get to be extolled by being banned. They're
that's
so
right.
banned that even their banning, the mentioning of their banning is banned. I mean, that's that's really banned.
That's really banned, yeah. And what finally pushed me over the edge of rage and got me to sit down and write this op-ed was an episode with that we had with the American Booksellers Association, which is one of the chief sponsors of Banned Books Week. And that involved Abigail Schreier's book, Irreversible Damage. And I mentioned this in that op-ed. The ABA, the American Booksellers Association, has a program they call a white box mailer. And if a publisher pays a fee, the ABA will put a review copy of a book into a small white box that's mailed every other month to their 750 member independent bookstores. So it's just a way of advertising your book to the book buyers, right? And independent bookstores are not generally friendly territory for Regnery Publishing or, you know, any other conservative authors or publishers. And we decided to send them Abigail's book, this book on the transgender craze among teenage girls, because in a funny way, it has attracted support from some unexpected quarters. There are a lot of feminists who generally probably wouldn't be too enamored with Regnery's line of books, but who are on the wrong side of this transgender thing, because they have decided that turning girls into boys
is anti-girl. Really
a feminist goal,
right?
So we sent it with the materials that we included with the book. You get a one page, you know, flyer was quotations from these kind of people.
Right.
We sent it out, and the box arrives at a bookstore in Brooklyn, and one of the employees there opens it up and suffers an experience, Jerry, that no American should have to go through. She was confronted with an objectionable opinion, you know, that had been printed. And so, like a good offended modern American, she went directly to Twitter and tweeted out to the world that the ABA had, you know, offended her in this grievous way by sending this book.
You know, I wonder to some degree if what we're seeing now maybe illustrates the degree to which there really is no neutrality.
I agree with you. I haven't had this conversation with Abigail. It would be interesting too. But I would predict that her experience with the promotion of irreversible damage has disabused her of any
neutral ground
ideas. Yeah, yeah. Yeah, I mean, it's true that she has, because of the kind of very narrow ground that she stakes out and what she's arguing about, she has been able to make her case in some fora that would not ordinarily be open to conservative writers. And so I wouldn't say it hasn't accomplished something. She was on Joe Rogan's podcast, and that's
a very free zone.
That's Joe, a free zone, exactly.
Yeah, yes.
Yeah. But anyway, no, I think you're right.
You can catch that full conversation at meetingofmindspodcast.com. It's a great new podcast that you or someone in your world may enjoy. Coming up,
Brave by Faith is not a call to try and be like Daniel, but it's actually a call to learn to trust God.
Alistair Begg on the courage of Daniel, when the Christian Outlook returns in a moment. Welcome back to the Christian Outlook, brought to you in partnership with the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy. Learn more at publicpolicy.pepperdine.edu. I'm Gino Geraci. There's no question that the years 2020 and 2021 have presented the church with a host of challenges. Of course, we've dealt with the pandemic and all the political issues related to it. We've seen the Black Lives Matter protests and the spike in crime in urban areas across the country. And we've been pushed by the leading edge of LGBTQ activism. Alistair Begg's new book is providentially timed. The title, Brave by Faith, God-Sized Confidence in a Post-Christian World. He joined Bob Lapine as he was hosting on KKLA in Los Angeles.
You think there's a winnowing going on in the evangelical church in America today?
Well, there's certainly a division going on. And yes, probably a winnowing. Because when the warfare gets a little more intense, then we find out who's really in it.
Right.
And who has just been along for the circus, as it were. And then there's also the pressure of seeming to be prepared to admit what the culture is telling us we need to admit, that we have been, along with other people, bad people, wrong people, that what we did when we took the good news into the heartlands of Africa was nothing other than colonialism. And now we've grown up and we've ditched that idea. And the pressure is significantly on, I think, particularly younger men who are trying to look around them and see, you know, where are the Daniels? Where are the Shadrach, Meshachs, and Abednego of the 21st century? Where are the young fellows with their heads on square that are prepared to stand against the tide? And I think that, you know, Brave by Faith is not a call to try and be like Daniel, but it's actually a call to to learn to trust God the way Daniel and his friends trusted God. And that, of course, is something that we can do.
If that's the major theme from the first half of Daniel, from all of Daniel, the idea that we can find our confidence in God even when we are outcasts and aliens, what are some of the practical implications that come out of Daniel's experience in Babylon that you think fit into where we are in 21st century America?
Well, I think one of the lessons that it seemed to come across very strongly to me, and it's not something that's stated, but it's something that's observable, because one has to ask the question, how is it that these fellows withstood these pressures? Because they were significant pressures. I mean, they changed their names. They changed their education. The entire cultural milieu in which they were now placed was so vastly different from what they had left behind. And I think one of the lessons for me is they were clearly grounded in their convictions. You know, in the same way that Paul says to Timothy, when Paul is leaving Timothy behind, and he says to him, what you need to do is continue in what you've become convinced of. And these fellows were convinced that God was who he said he was. And what happens is that they actually believe what they say they believe. It moves for them into a realm that is clearly not theoretical at any point at all. But they have their fixed points. And when those fixed points are challenged, then they're prepared to say, you know, we can go this far, but we can't go any further than this. I've got a sneaking feeling that there's a great danger in contemporary evangelicalism that there still is such a lingering desire to be well thought of by the culture that we're prepared to capitulate on all kinds of things when in actual fact we daren't do so for the well-being of our day and also for the well-being of those who follow us.
So unpack that a little bit for us, because we want to be winsome enough to be able to articulate the gospel and to not be off-putting to our unsaved neighbors. How do we find that space between being winsome enough without capitulating and being too culturally accommodating?
You know, again, the example of these fellows is a good example, because let's not forget that they were highly prized. They were highly regarded because of their character, because, if you like, they showed up for work when they said they would. They put in their day. They were honest. They were truthful. They were useful. They were effective. They were standouts. And the reason that they were opposed was not because they were useless. It was because they were so good. And so, you know, Daniel rises to such a position of prominence, not because he's a rabble-rouser, not because he's taking on the culture, not because he's constantly pointing out everything that's wrong, but just because he does what he's been asked to do, and he does it in a way that is so undeniably quality that only those who hate him can oppose him. And that, of course, is exactly what they do. And the only way they can find a way to get at him is on the strength of his resolutions. They could never find him at prayer if he wasn't regularly praying. They wouldn't be able to accuse him of these things. They knew exactly. So I think there's a danger that at the moment people think that they're really taking a stand for the gospel when they get up on their political soapbox and bang on about whatever the moral issue of the day is. And there is a place, of course, for us holding the line on that, and so we must. But that wasn't what Daniel was doing. Daniel wasn't there to point out to the Babylonians how they had got everything wrong. He was there simply living out the principles with which he had grown up, and he lived out of those convictions.
Coming up,
we live in Babylon. No matter what you think about Washington, D.C. or London or Paris or whatever it is.
More with Alistair Begg when the Christian Outlook returns in a moment.
The Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy believes in the calling to politics and public service. As one of the few programs of its kind based at a leading Christian university, we prepare students for exciting careers in this vital arena through a curriculum that combines rigorous study of America's founding principles with the latest tools of policy analysis. The application period for fall 2022 classes has begun, so find out more at pepperdine.edu/SPP. That's pepperdine.edu/SPP.
Welcome back to the Christian Outlook. I'm Gino Geraci, host of Crosswalk on 94.7 FM The Word in Denver. As we look at the life of Daniel, we see a biblical example of faithfulness in his own extraordinary times.
If we're going to remain faithful in the days and times that the Lord has us living through, we too have to be prepared. And those of us who are parents have a duty and an obligation to prepare our families as well. Let's return to Bob Lapine's conversation with Alistair Begg talking about brave by faith.
Do you have any idea how old Daniel was as we read these stories about him?
Well, by the time we get to the end, he was an old man. I think we can safely assume that they were, at the very latest, at the beginning of the story, only probably touching 20 or their 21st birthday, or maybe even a little younger than that, in their teens. And so the story of Daniel proceeds over a fair period of time. And so there's another lesson in that, that, you know, it's one thing to be a flash in the pan for a moment or two,
right,
but it's another thing to live consistently trusting in God.
Well, and I'm thinking if Daniel was late teens when he's standing steadfast with Nebuchadnezzar and coming up with creative alternatives to the diet that is being proposed that would violate the Hebrew diet and refusing to capitulate, something had to be going on in Daniel's home to prepare him, because cultural assimilation, the Babylonians were working overtime to try to get these Jewish slaves to become Babylonians, right?
Yep, that's exactly right. But don't let's forget, the reason we know about these fellows is because they must have been standouts even amongst others who were in a similar situation to themselves. And not all of them were marching in step with Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. The reason we know about them is because they were peculiar. You know, this is a reminder to us, isn't it, that God in every generation, you know, lays his hand on individuals, young men, young women, and marks them out. That's what, you know, I'm praying for now. It's, you know, as I stand on the threshold of my 70th year, that before my hair all falls out or turns an unmistakably white color, that I might manage to pass on to the next generation the same sense of the awesomeness of God and the conviction that his word is reliable, that the gospel is true, that it is powerful, that it is relevant, and so on. And so, you know, if you back it up to, you know, the exile, that's the story. We're living in the exile. We live in Babylon. No matter what you think about Washington, D.C., or London, or Paris, or whatever it is, we are aliens and strangers. We live in foreign territory. And the whole issue is who is the king and who is it that we serve? And then we work things out from there. I'm not sure that many of us have actually settled that issue. And so we're trapped somewhere between our political agitation and, if you like, our theological orientation.
All of us, we want to be liked. Nobody doesn't want to be liked. We would like to have some social currency and to have people respect us. And yet our Christian convictions are increasingly at odds, rather than social currency, it's social deficit in our day. And I'm thinking of teenagers. I'm thinking of kids in middle school who are quickly learning that to stand for Christ as a 15-year-old could get you in trouble with the teacher, with the administration. Certainly your friends are going to be harder to find. I talked to a mom, Alistair, recently, whose 14-year-old wanted to put a rainbow flag on her Facebook page. And the mom said, "Now, why do you want to do that?" And she said, "Because I'm the only one in my class that hasn't done it yet." And so here's the pressure at age 14.
Yeah.
If you want to fit in here, this is how you live. Daniel somehow withstood that pressure in a creative way. How do we as moms and dads keep that from happening with our kids?
Well, we're learning it. I mean, we're learning it now, at least I am, at the level of my grandchildren, because the pressures are immense. And I think, you know, coming out of Great Britain, I have not been, you know, a sort of Christian school, homeschool kind of person, because what I enjoyed in the UK growing up, I thought was duplicated over here. It's taken me a little while to realize that I missed that one completely. And so part of what we have to do now is ensure that our children are under the tutelage of people who share our worldview, people who are prepared to withstand the sort of prevailing notions that seek to reinterpret the issue of gender or whatever it might be. And it's not that we have to take this on as our crusade, but it is, I think, important for us to be brave enough to say that if you are born as a man, you will die as a man, no matter what you do to yourself along the journey of life. Now, of course, that is hate speech back in Scotland now. That is the kind of thing that, you know, can get you rounded up and taken in for an inquiry. So, yeah, it's amazing. In Scotland, too, the Scottish government have just passed some resolutions suggesting that children as young as kindergarten children can inform their teachers that they prefer to be called by different pronouns without ever informing their parents of their desire. And if you want to see the slide across the ocean coming this way, then I guarantee you it's coming like a tidal wave.
It won't be long, that's right. And I'm wondering, Alistair, if you find yourself throughout the day getting angry or keeping your head down or retreating. I mean, I know I do. I hear things and see things, and they provoke me to anger, or they cause me to want to just go home and shut the door and not talk to anybody.
Yes, I think it would be only honest to say yes, probably to all of the above. Our emotions can ebb and flow. Mine can. And, you know, often when we realize the onslaught of the media that is a prevailing wind in the face of sort of biblical absolutes, the extent to which, fascinatingly, we now have an apocalypse for the greater part of the end of the 20th century. You know, the secularists wanted to say, who are these crazy people who have got all this story about the world coming to an end and trying to scare us and everything? Well, we sort of toned that down, only to find that it's picked up by the climate change people. And there's not a day in your life where you're not told about the impending doom. The Christian story is that it could happen any day. The climate story is that it is a really significant problem, and probably in 220 years, it will really start to lay hold of you. And so it's quite amazing to me how the tables have turned. And so again, here in this issue, we've got this notion of, you know, is God contained in his creation? That's the view of contemporary man. It's pantheism.
Coming up,
it's an exciting time to be alive. What an adventure.
A closing challenge from Alistair Begg in the final segment of The Christian Outlook.
This week on Meeting of Minds podcast with Jerry Boyer, I talk with Tom Spence, who's the head of Regnery Publishing, about the farce that is Banned Books Week.
None of the books that you'll find promoted in your bookstore or at your public library during Banned Books Week has ever been banned in any real sense. The place that you'll find most of the titles from the Banned Books Week promotion is the bestseller list. So they're, you know, not really banned. What they have in common is not that someone from the government or Big Brother has removed them from the market. What they have in common is that they almost entirely express a left-wing point of view on something, and usually something having to do with sex or race, you know, kind of the woke topics.
To hear the rest of the interview with Tom Spence from Regnery Publishing, tune in to meetingofmindspodcast.com.
Welcome back to The Christian Outlook. I'm Gino Geraci. The biblical figure Daniel paid a heavy price for his faith. As our country and culture changes so quickly in front of us, there are no doubt many that are going to have to pay a price for our faith. But that doesn't mean that we should approach these days with dour pessimism. These are the days that God has called us to, and this is a great time to be a Christian. Let's return to Alistair Begg with Bob Lapine.
I think some of us as pastors are eventually going to go to jail, and hopefully it will be good ones that go and not clowns. And some of the people who are in the biochemical world are going to have to be prepared to lose their credentials. And some who are in the high levels of corporate America are going to have to be prepared to take the hit and lose their stock options because they said, no, we refuse to do this. And some people are actually not going to be elected to political office because they're actually prepared to say, this is actually what I believe. It's an exciting time to be alive. What an adventure.
You say that, and I think that's a great response here at the end, because most people hear you say that and say, what a fearful time to be alive. And can't we just get back to the old days where it was much easier?
No, I know. I get it. I saw the T-shirt. It says, "Lord, if you're not coming back soon," on the back it says, "Please send Ronald Reagan."
So as Christians, should our voice and our tone in the current culture be prophetic and forceful, or should it be kind and compassionate?
It should be prophetically compassionate, compassionately forceful. I mean, the idea of if it's an either or, the fact that people are very poor at holding the line without just shouting at people, those people are not to have a voice. We need people who can actually dance, if you like. And I don't mean by that they can speak out of two sides of their mouths or dance on one side and dance on the other. But in the same way like Muhammad Ali, you know, he danced. I mean, they were coming at him big time. He knew when to hit him with that left jab. He knew when to throw a punch. But he also knew that you don't just go in there and fight like a crazy person, because it's not going to work. And I think that's where we need, in conservative Christian talk, we just don't need the strident tone of people drumming on about the same thing, speaking to themselves. We need people who can cross the divide the way, you know, Reagan crossed the divide with Tip O'Neill. Mm-hmm. People who can disagree with people without being horribly disagreeable. But the way the whole thing is set up, it's, you know, people are not looking for your opinion. They're just reinforcing their view. And so it's a real challenge, because the idea of dialogue has virtually disintegrated, particularly in the last 18 months. And the whole idea of canceling anybody who's got a view different from your own is, of course, a phenomenal absurdity. And yet it seems to almost reign supreme.
That wraps up this edition of the Christian Outlook. You can catch the remainder of Alistair Begg with Bob Lapine at ChristianOutlook.com. Thanks for joining us today. Our program has been brought to you in part through our partnership with the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy. For executive producer Russell Shubin and producers Charlie Richards and David Pishon and Mike Cook, I'm Gino Geraci. Join us next time for the Christian Outlook.
Three-star general Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.